You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Welcome to this week's Mysteries and Monsters. This week, my guest is one of the leading lights in British paganism, Steve Jones. Steve has been one of the driving forces in the continued resurgence in paganism here in the UK, so we discuss how he became involved with paganism, his forming of the oldest moot based in Wakefield, West Yorkshire, as well as the differences between paganism and Wicca. Steve is also a paranormal investigator who specialises in unusual hauntings, especially hooded entities. We cover chaos magic, earthworks, stone circles, and the most unusual of hauntings, toilets with resident ghosts. It was really interesting to talk to Steve, and I know you'll find it interesting too. Don't forget, if you're hungry for more episodes, bonus content, articles, and a chance to win exclusive Patreon-only merchandise, then you can sign up to our Patreon via patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters for just $4 a month. A bargain, I think. Keep an eye on our social media, as I'm about to launch some t-shirts due to the demand of people asking if I would do some. So, you'd better order some now. The full range of merchandise will be available from July the 1st on both Redbubble and TeePublic, so check them out. Don't forget, if you've already got some merchandise, or you're about to buy some, stick it on social media, tag us in, and we'll share it with our followers. Don't forget, we're also on all social media platforms. Just search for Mysteries and Monsters to find us. And we've got some great shows coming up in July. So thank you for your continued support, and keep leaving those brilliant reviews on your podcast apps to help the show grow and reach new listeners. Okay. Let's go on the hunt for hooded entities and ghosts with pagan Steve Jones. This week, I'm delighted to be joined by Steve Jones, one of Britain's most notable pagans. Steve has been a driving force in the promotion of paganism and is responsible for creating and running the oldest pagan moot based in Wakefield, West Yorkshire, in the UK. Steve has a lifelong interest in the fields of Fortiana, the paranormal and folklore, and he has graced the stage of many a British Fortean conference, and has a keen interest in hooded entities. Steve, thank you for joining me today. Welcome.
Welcome, Paul.
So how are we? How are things?
Not too bad, like everybody else, hunkering down.
Yeah.
And coping with the wonders of Skype, Zoom, etc.
Yes, I think we've all learnt a lot about online meetings.
Yep.
And video conferencing across the world. So yeah, I've certainly increased my skill set in regards to numerous programs, I think, over this lockdown period, Steve.
Yeah, I think the beauty is that we've all just started to realise now that we can talk to researchers in other countries.
Yes.
Because we've not really, well, speaking personally, I've not really done that before. And now I am chatting to people around the world, time zone permitting.
Yeah, absolutely. The same here. Yeah, yeah. It's been a fantastic time for. I think a lot of people have actually started talking a bit more. I think the problem we've got with social media is it's very easy just to focus on updates and things, Steve, and not actually speak to people.
Yeah, exactly. And I think one thing that this has brought home to a lot of people is that you need to be talking to people now,
yeah,
before sadly they pass on.
Yes.
And you lose what they've actually said. We've had two very, very well-known people in the Wiccan community die in the past 2 days.
Oh, dear.
So it's been a shock to a few. Well, they were, you know, they were getting on, obviously.
Yes.
But to have two, one after another go, then people have been to say, well, we need to be recording stuff, so.
Yeah, yeah, it's one of those times, I think, that it just proves that you've just got to take the bull by the horn, Steve, and live the life for the moment, because in these circumstances, you just don't know what's around the corner, unfortunately.
No, exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
So, as I touched on in your introduction, Steve, you are one of our most notable pagans, but you are also, I believe, or were, the only sitting magistrate who identified as a pagan.
I was, yes. I did 21 years on the, first of all, the Wakefield, and then following the closure of Wakefield Magistrates Court, the Barnsley Magistrates Court, up to last year. And I was the only person, when you apply to be a magistrate, anybody can apply to be a magistrate, but on the form that you had to fill in, it actually things like, are you a Freemason, which I wasn't. It amused me because it doesn't say, is anybody else in your family a Freemason? And my dad was at the time. And then there's a little bit on it that says, you know, is there anything in your sort of personal or private life that might reflect badly on the bench or, you know, possible? And I just ticked it, and it was like a box to tick, but then it didn't really say, what is it? And then at the end, there was a bit further, so I put, I am a practicing witch. And of course, when I was called for an interview, that was the first thing they wanted to know. You know, it's like, and at the time they thought that witches would be all sort of namby-pamby, let him go, it wasn't his fault, etc.
Yes.
And the first thing I got in the first interview was, you know, what would you do on the bench? And I said, well, the thing is, we believe in what you give out, you get back. So if you've done a crime, you should do the time, you know.
Mm. Yeah.
And it's like, oh, right. And they soon found out when I did get on the bench, because I was asked, you know, what would I do if a pagan came in front of me on the bench? Mm. And I'm proud to say, in 21 years, I never, ever had a pagan in front of me. I had a few vicars, but no pagan. But I did say, if there was anybody that I actually knew, obviously I would come down off the bench, because it would be a conflict, obviously.
Yeah.
And it actually took the press a few years to figure out that I was actually a pagan. They did actually find out, because if people remember, I think it was around 2000, there was very, very bad floods in York that flooded a lot of York. And they included the York Dungeon at the time. And what York Dungeon did, they thought, what are we doing? It gives an opportunity to revamp. So in the revamp, they actually put in a section on the witch trials. And then they asked for a witch to open to do it. And they approached various friends of mine, all of them said no. And then somebody must have said, well, ask Steve Jones, he's an idiot, he'll do it. So they came... So they came to me, and I said, yeah, fine, as long as it's not being made fun of, because they wanted me to do it in a robe, and I said, I will do it, but not be made fun of. And then they sent me a press release, which I must admit I skimmed, which you should never, ever do with the press. So I missed the bit that said Steve Jones practicing magistrate, and it went out, and of course... The poor York Dungeon, all the press wanted to know was this witch who was a magistrate. So I ended up, first I knew, I got the Yorkshire Evening Post on to me, and a guy from there wanted an interview, which I gave him.
Yep.
But unbeknownst to me, he was a stringer from the News of the World. So the next thing I knew was when somebody rang me up and said, you know, you're in the News of the World. I said, no, because I never read the rag. And from there, it sort of took off. And the best one was somebody said, do you know you're in the new musical Express? And it's like, really? Oh. Wow. NME had an online bit about weird stories. And it, if I remember right, it was the Spice Girls, Madonna, and me.
Yeah.
One of my claims to fame. But it got a bit out of hand when a German TV crew actually rang the magistrate's court and asked if they could have an interview with me, unbeknownst to me. And the magistrate's clerk sort of rang me up and said, I think you'd better come in for a talk. And we had a chat, and they were fine. They backed me all the way, and I made it quite plain that, like now, I'm making it quite plain. I'm speaking as a pagan, not as a magistrate, and I would not be quoted as a magistrate.
Yeah.
And I would not be taken as speaking for all the magistrates, you know. It would be me personally. But other than that, I never had a problem with it. And it was quite useful, chatting to people. And in fact, I used to sit with the Dean of Wakefield Cathedral's wife at one time.
Mm.
and if there was anything ghostly or stuff come up. The only thing that annoyed me was Wakefield Magistrates Court, which is still there but closed now, is a very old building. It was originally built as a police station, then it became a fire station, and then it became the Magistrates Court. So it's a real warren of rooms and that, and not really suitable at times. And I kept asking if it was haunted. And everyone sort of looked at me and, oh, no, sir, no, no. And then on the very last day, they had a closing ceremony, and we were all invited, and I was sitting there, and they were doing the talks. And then they said, and the staff will be very sorry to say goodbye to the ghost. And I went, what? And it turned out that there had been a ghost there all along that haunted the staff thing, and they just never told me, which annoyed me.
Oh. Frustrating, if nothing else, Steve. You know, it's in
exactly,
your element.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's closed now, so I can't get in. Yeah.
Ah, typical, typical. So, Steve, what drew your interest first? Then was it your interest in weird things and Fortiana that drew you to paganism, or was it paganism that drew you to Fortiana?
I was a pagan first. I was brought up a Roman Catholic. And I went to secondary school in Blackpool, where I was taught by the Christian Brothers in Upstead. But I was fed up with their attitude, which is basically Catholics are right and everybody else is wrong. So I got fed up with that and sort of jettisoned Roman Catholicism. I stopped going to Mass, etc. Because my late granny was very, very religious until the day she died. But then I went through the phase I think virtually all lads go through, certainly. I was reading horror books, I was watching horror movies, ghost films. I started to want to know more about it, so I started to read ghost stories, any paranormal stuff I could lay my hand on. And that was it, really. I was sort of more into paranormal and 14 stuff. But obviously when you start reading that, what really got me interested was in the 1970s, I moved to York, and I was looking around, there was a left-wing collected bookshop, I suppose you'd call it, used to sell old books on laid-back, but they had one little section, which had got some books on tarot and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I ended up buying a tarot deck. And I got the worst tarot deck you could ever have, which is one, I think they still do, it's called the Swiss 1JJ deck, which is, it's one that's got Juno and Jupiter in place of the Emperor and Empress. And the instructions that came with it were not very good, so I started buying other books on the tarot. And then reading about the esoteric side of it got me interested in the Golden Dawn. And then from there, I sort of started to read more and got me reading about witchcraft. And around that time, they started to be publishing, there was a publisher called Robert Hale, who started to publish books on witchcraft by proper English witches. And I was lucky enough to buy Eight Sabbath Witches by Janet Stuart Farrer. I thought, oh, right, so this is what they do. And I was also, at the time, doing tarot readings in psychic fairs. So I was meeting people who claimed to be witches, and I was chatting to them. And gradually from there, I got an interest. And then eventually set up my own company.
So, was that when you moved over to Yorkshire then, Steve, that you set up the coven, or was that where you were based in Lancashire?
Yeah, that was in Lancashire. I was actually living at a place called Bromley Cross, which is between Bolton and Blackburn. Bromley Cross is it's a stop on the railway line between Blackburn and Bolton. And it's got some interesting things in the area. There's a little old peel tower called Turton Tower just up the road, which has a couple of screaming skulls, for example, and lots of ghosts around. And the area at the back's got standing stone. And in the days when I lived there, you could actually still see the screaming skulls. You can't see them now, they're not on display, but they were back there. So that was an interesting area. And yeah, I was living there, and because I was living at home, obviously I couldn't practice paganism there. My parents were not interested. Yes. And they want me to do it. So I used to go over to, I used to subscribe to various magazines, Pentagram magazine, if anyone remembers that. There was a very short-lived magazine called Pentacore magazine in the 1970s, which was an A5 mag. Not particularly brilliant, but it had a free ad section that people could write in for. So if you wanted to meet an astrologer or a ghost hunter or a witch, you could place a free ad. And there was an ad for it, and it said something on the lines of, long-haired, I think it's 24-year-old at the time, something like long-haired 24-year-old with own temple wishes to meet people in Lancashire. And as I hadn't got a girlfriend, and it's somebody in Preston, and I thought, ooh, 24-year-old girl in Preston with her own temple, that sounds good. So I replied to, wrote it off to the side, and I got a reply from a bloke called Simon. And I then reread the ad and realised it said long-haired 24-year-old. It didn't say female. I just assumed that. And this is the 70s. And my mate Simon, as he became, had just come back from Canada in his long-haired face. And he was living in a house in Preston. And he turned the cellar into a temple. And that's where we sort of tried to set up our first coven. He had a massive stone that he'd humped all the way back from the Lake District, which was his old, got various other stuff. And being rather naive, although I knew a little bit more about the press than he did, we contacted the Manchester Evening News, basically said, you know, do you want to interview some witches? Because we had a couple of girls that wanted to join, but I never really got to meet them, so I never met them. Because what happened, the Manchester News went, oh yeah. But then they sent a feature writer. Now, we didn't quite realise that a feature writer is, you know, not the person who reports on the local dog show. Yes. And they sent a photographer. And of course, they wanted to know, hey, this was in November, could they film any women? Was there any girls? And we said, no, then they're working, you know, these two blokes, which the guy was a bit disappointed about. Because he got there first, and he interviewed both of us and was asking us what we did, and we were explaining. And once he was convinced that there weren't any girls, but the photographer went sort of great when he saw the cellar, and wow, that was fantastic, you know, like a hammer film. So we got some great black and white shots of Simon in his robe and me standing there, actually with I'm actually stood in the photographs with a blanket wrapped around me to look like a cloak, because I didn't have my robe. Which doesn't look too bad. And then the article came out in the Manchester Evening News, which my relatives in Manchester saw, but luckily my parents didn't. So, just like, oh, Stephen's in the paper. Oh, yeah, right. And then they never saw it. But then what happened after that was that time the Manchester Evening News was also owned the Lancashire Evening Post. They subsequently split. So the Lancashire Evening Post approached Simon and said, could they do another article? And at the time I was on the dole, I said, well, I can't come over there. So they did it with him. And it was the headline paper, you know, all the things, Secret Coven revealed in Preston. I have to wonder whether that stone's still there, because what happened, Simon was in a rented house and his landlord came out, because you've seen the article, and basically just sounds like he's been thrown out on the street, and basically sort of went down to the cellar and said, as long, oh, well, you've not damaged my house, or you bought this big rock in, but you've not damaged it, you're fine. But the funny thing was, the next door house was actually a Mormon missionary house. When the Mormons come round over here from the States, they put up at places owned by the church, and then they go out from there to knock on your door, and they were next door. And they'd been playing basketball with Simon until the article came out, and then they came around to tell us that under no circumstances was he ever to cross their door again, you know.
No.
Well, they'd pray for him.
Oh, well, thank goodness for that.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was my first group, and then I moved over here to Yorkshire, and I set up a group over here and met other groups, and subsequently that broke up. But you know, I've met people all the time, and I, as I say, I went along to a group called PaganLink, which was a short-lived group. Well, I'm saying shortly, but it lasted about 9 years. Mm. Who set up moots for people to go to, where you met people from all over. And I've gone to my first one in Leeds. On the way back on the bus, I was trying to offend, and I said, "That's an idea. We should have one in Wakefield." Mm. So we set one up, and then my friend dropped out after the first one, and that left me. And I've been running it ever since, so over 30 years.
Yeah, that was, and is it still the longest one in continuously in the UK,
yeah,
Steve?
It's the longest running continuous one in the UK, alone for the fact we've not had it, obviously, since the lockdown, because all the pubs are shut.
Yes.
But once the pubs reopen, it will happen. And we did actually do a virtual moot online, so we've kept it going.
Fantastic, fantastic. So, my understanding, moot is an old term for meeting place, I believe, or where thinking people would go?
Yes, it is. The word moot is a contraction from the Saxon word witangi moot, which meant meeting of the wise. And it was the name for the village meeting. So every village at one time you'd have your moot hall. That's why you've still got moot halls in some villages, because everybody got together. It was like, you know, before the parish councils, you had the moot, and the villagers got together, decided, you know, who was going to get the fields, who was breaking the fences down, who wasn't looking after the cattle properly, you know, etc. And they could find people, they could carry out various things as well. So that was the local moot. Mm. And that's where the phrase a moot point comes from.
Yeah.
Because that would be something that you'll be going to raise at your local moot.
Mm. Mm.
And when the meetings first started, the Earth Mysteries people, when they first started, they wanted a name for their meetings. And they decided, well, moot sounds a bit more archaic than meet. So we'll call our meetings moots.
Mm.
And one of the first pagan moots in the country was in Leeds, and the people that went there, some were Earth Mysteries people, and the pagans said, "Oh, that's a good idea, that's a good name, we'll use that." So we've been calling them moots ever since.
Fantastic. I mean, I think for a lot of people as well, Steve, for most people outside, I think there's a bit of confusion between Wicca and Wiccans and pagans and paganism. So do you find that frustrating that people still mix the two up?
Yeah, because it's like being a Christian. The word pagan is an umbrella term.
Mm.
So, like, you can meet somebody and you say, "Are you a Christian?" And they say, "Yeah." And then you say, "Well, what denomination are you? Are you, you know, Catholic? Are you Protestant? Are you Seventh-day Adventist? You know, monster raving in the war?" And the same way, somebody says they're a pagan. Well, Wiccan is just one of the denominations of paganism. Because nowadays there's lots of different ones, and there's, you know, there's people who worship Greek gods, Roman gods, Celtic deities, you name it. And then people who are interested in the Norse, Scandinavian, Germanic pantheon, they don't call themselves pagans, they call themselves heathens. Which is a similar thing. I mean,
yeah,
pagan is Latin for people of the countryside. Heathen is from people of the heath, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So it's just a distinction based on their particular denomination.
Yeah, yeah. Heathens don't particularly want to be called pagans.
Yeah.
Which is why when the census comes around, they don't put that they're pagans, they put they're heathens.
Yeah, yes. Interesting. I mean, have you noticed, Steve, as well, because I know in over the last couple of censuses that we've done in the UK, paganism seems to have been something that a lot of people identify with these days.
Oh yeah, in the last one it was worked out that if everybody that was a pagan had actually put pagan instead of saying I'm Wiccan, pagan, heathen, Odinist or whatever, we would actually have outnumbered the Buddhists.
Yeah.
Which is saying a lot. It's trying to get us all to agree on something is another matter, it's an ongoing religion, it's a living religion because it's changing, so it doesn't have a set book, unlike other religions. So, you know, you can get Wiccan, the odd Wiccan fundamentalist saying, if it's not in the way of the Book of Shadows, the way Joe Gardner did it, we're not doing it. But others have amended, come up with their own rituals, done their own thing. So it's living in that sense, and it's still evolving. And it attracts a lot of people. It attracts a lot of people because we've got people interested in the earth. It's an earth religion, fertility religion. Mm. So a lot of the good people in are also in the Green Party, etc. But, you know, it covers a wide range of areas. And it's the only religion that we actually gave to the world, if you count it as Wicca. Because Wicca started in the UK and was taken abroad, and it's now all around the world, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. It did seem to be one of those things, because I think Wicca really had an explosion in the post-war years, Steve, which is, I think, as we've touched on in previous conversations, more to do with the repealing of the Witchcraft Act.
Yes, until 1951, it was technically illegal to be a witch. I mean, the last prosecution for witchcraft was actually in 1944, mm-hmm. And that was Helen Duncan, who was prosecuted under the Act, although she was actually a practicing spiritualist medium and not a witch at all. Mm-hmm. But it was used to prosecute her by the then government because of things she was saying. But it was as a result of that and the pressure by the spiritualist church to get the Act repealed and get a pardon, that the then last existing Witchcraft Act was wiped off, and it was replaced with the Fraudulent Mediums Act. Mm. And it specifically, because it was the Fraudulent Mediums Act in 1951, it specifically was there to prosecute people who were fraudulent. Yeah. So by default, it accepted that people could have psychic abilities.
Mm.
And that included people saying that, you know, I'm a witch and I can do spells, etc.
Yeah.
What a lot of people still don't realise is that that was actually repealed because of pressure from various quarters, and the Fraudulent Mediums Act is no longer in force, and it was replaced with a Consumer Protection Act, which basically says if you say I'm selling a spell on eBay or whatever, you have to say this is for entertainment purposes only. Otherwise, you can be prosecuted and fined or sent to prison.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that was one of those things as well, Steve, because there was obviously a massive explosion in psychics appearing on television in the late 90s and early noughties. And I think there was a kind of a real determined effort to sort of bring them under some kind of regulation, I think. And it was that was a real big driving force in that as well.
That was part of it, yeah. But the repeal was sort of just before most sovereignty got going and stuff like that. So it was slipped in as part of a consumer protection. So it was done without people realising it was done, and it was too late once it had been passed. But yeah, that's why sort of most sovereignty has to say this is for entertainment purposes, you know. And that's why the late Derek Acora, you know, was sort of running around having to say what it was actually, you know, doing this for entertainment and not really talking. Although, obviously, he was still claiming to be in touch with Sam until the day he died, I think.
Yes, yeah, which was just quite recently. Was it just after Christmas?
Yeah, just before this lot, yeah. I only met him once, and that was when Most Haunted was just starting, and I'd never seen it. But I was at the Fortune Times convention, and they had a stall there. Must have been about the second or possibly even the third series of it.
Yeah.
Because I was chatting to Kieran, about some ghosts and vigils, and Acora wandered up and butted into the conversation. And the thing was, I didn't know who he was because I'd never watched it, and I wasn't a fan of football, so I never knew him as football.
Yeah.
But having worked with psychic fairs, I could recognise a fake psychic from a real one, and I sort of said to him, look pal, I don't know who you are, but he obviously is psychic as a brick wall, and he put the hoff and wandered up. Nope. And that was the one and only time I ever met him.
Well, what a meeting, Steve.
Yeah.
Oh, it is strange. I know since I've been doing this show, I've been to a few conferences. And last year I went to my first ever UFO conference, which I was expecting to be quite woo. And it was surprisingly normal. And then about 3 weeks after that, I went to a psychic fair. And I was just blown away. You know, there's people there with a stall saying they're the reincarnation of an Egyptian princess.
Oh, yeah.
And I was just like, what? It was a lot more woo than any UFO conference I suspect anybody could have got. It was very strange for me, because it was almost like I got the wrong effect at the wrong venue.
New Age gets very, very woo, and also very expensive.
Yes.
There's an old joke about what's the difference between New Age and pagan.
I don't know.
About 30 quid an hour.
Well, to be fair, there was somebody with a stall there selling Ouija boards for £100, so I suspect they're onto a good thing, Steve. They did look very nice, but I don't think they're worth £100. So for you as a pagan, do you, and being a witch, Steve, do you ever get called out to assist people, or do people come to you wanting assistance for various things?
Over the years they have, but the first thing you do is look at why do they want to do it. I mean, the first thing, if anyone says they're a witch, and I can guarantee that anyone who's listening to this is a pagan and know exactly where I'm coming from, people first of all ask you, do you do spells? And you go, well, yeah, but not often. Mm-hmm. And then the first one they ask is, can you do me a love spell?
Yes.
And my answer to that one is, well, the easiest love spell is to get them to say yes, because you know, yes, we can, but I don't do it, because what they basically want is usually be their male or female spoken to the person and been told, no, I wouldn't go to bed with you with a 9-foot barge pole. And then they come to the witch, and if you do a spell to sort of tie them two people together, or well, basically in most cases it's that this one will have sex with somebody, you as a witch can get involved. You don't want to. And also, if you bind them together or do a binding spell or whatever your spell you do, they can have sex. Yes, it can work. But then, unless the witch breaks the spell, that them two people are stuck together. So the bloke who just wants to get the girl into bed, or vice versa, get sex, gets up, wanders off, will find they can't. They'll keep running into them. They won't be able to get rid of them until you break the spell.
Yeah, and I suppose
it's too much hassle.
Yeah, and I suppose there's quite a dangerous precedent there, Steve, because essentially you're trying to help someone get something that, under normal means, they've been told no chance.
Yeah, I mean, people are always waffling on about white and black magic, and there isn't really a white and black magic, that's a Christian term. It's the intention behind it.
Yes.
I always say, for example, my test for people is, right, if I did a spell to make everybody give, say, 100 quid to Greenpeace, would that be white or black magic? Most people go, oh yeah, that'd be white magic. We really got to know it isn't. If you were going to give 100 quid, you would have done it. If I make you do it against your will, then technically that is black magic, if you want to put it in those terms, you know.
Yeah. Essentially, the negative connotation, if it's essentially forcing someone against their will, that's where it crosses the line, Steve.
It all depends on the witch. Mm. You know, what one person's idea of what works is different to another one's. Mm. So there is no you know, clear cut white and black. It's what we intend to do. So you know, if I intend to do something for something, I might think it's good, and another person might think, no, actually that's wrong. So I might have done a spell saying, right, oh yeah, that's great, let's give them 100 quid each. And somebody's like, no, you shouldn't have done that, you know.
Yeah.
So it's the intention behind it, and that's what people don't realise. It's not necessarily, you know, good or bad. I mean, some Wiccans are going, had it harm none? Well, no, that's not what everybody does. If somebody deserves it, then people would do magic against somebody, you know.
Yeah.
What you do is speed the karma up so they get what they deserve, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
or you do a spell to remove them so that they're, if they've been an absolute pain in the neck for people, really nasty types, then you can do something so that suddenly they'll move on, you know, or suddenly they get another job offer, or they get booted out of the property they're in, or whatever, you know. But you can do it so that it's a positive thing, you know. So suddenly somebody, say, who's annoying the neighbours who hasn't got a job, suddenly they've got a job offer and they move elsewhere. So that removes them from the neighbours. But for them it's positive, you know. Or you could do it so that, you know, the landlord comes around and boots them out for being a pain in the neck, or they get arrested.
Yeah. 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 I mean, have you ever found yourself being contacted by people who need help with the paranormal due to your paganism, Steve? Or is it something that tends to be more sort of prosaic requests?
No, I have with the paranormal, because partly with the move, because obviously the move's over to everybody. It's don't have to be a pagan to turn up. In fact, most of the time we spend more time talking about ghost stories and hauntings than anything else.
Yeah.
I have been asked to help out. I have done the odd sort of cleansing of properties. The best one I ever did, for an immediate one, but you'll have to take my word for this, because it was a girl in Leeds who was living on a council estate. She had an abusive boyfriend who had been beating her up. And she tried everything, and he kept coming round, and she asked me, would I do something for protection? Could I do it? And I said, yes, or we could do it together. So I did a ritual for this woman, and she obviously hadn't told him. He wasn't living in the house at the time. She managed to chuck him out, keep him out, which is why he's coming back. And we did this ritual, and I sort of how to, we went through and cleansed the house, and we cleansed the bedroom, and I actually saw this of black energy leaving the bedroom. And we cleansed it. We went through the whole house, and I did a circle of protection around the house. I mean, it was a council house, so it was a semi, but we did it that way. 5 minutes after we'd finished, and I was getting changed into my normal clothes, I've been wearing a robe, she was getting changed into her clothes, there was a knock on the door. When she opened the door, it was a council workman. And he said, oh, we've come to repair your fence, because the fence in the front garden was broken down into bits, and she complained and complained, but had nothing out of it, and suddenly there they were repairing the fence, which they did.
Yeah.
And she was looking at me going, wow. But also the guy somehow got to hear, and she said, I've never told, I don't know how he knows it, that this witch had been done, and he stayed well clear, because he was absolutely terrified. That a witch, and also that she'd been involved in witchcraft, and thought she would put a spell on him, and that was it, and it cured it.
Ah.
So you can work, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. So, through that then, Steve, is that what kind of, I mean, because obviously you've got a keen interest in ghosts, and especially as we touched on it right at the beginning of your introduction, and of hooded entities. So,
That was just part of it. I mean, it's something I've been interested in now for nearly 30 years, but it was just as part of my interest in ghosts and whatever. I'm also interested in, as you'll have gathered by now, in a lot of stuff, including Earth Mystery, Stone Circle, stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I have a mate who now lives in Scotland called Paul Bennett, who's an Earth Mysteries researcher. At the time I met Paul, he was actually living over at Shipley. He comes from Bradford, he was at Shipley, mate. And he'd been looking, Paul is a great collector of old books and old documents, and has a fantastic library. And he'd actually found in an old book about Ilkley Moor a reference to a broken stone circle somewhere near White Wells on Ilkley Moor. And he thought, I know Ilkley Moor really well, and I don't know where this is. So he recruited a guy called Nigel Mortimer, who at the time was friends and subsequently fell out, who may be familiar to some people, because Nigel's also in the UFO scene, and he's a dowser. And they mapped out to see roughly where this site was, and then they found what they thought was the site. They went over from White Wells, found it, and it's near Backstone Beck. We call it Backstone Circle now, but it's a circle that's been built into. They've used some of the stones for dry stone walls.
Mm.
And it looks like at one time there was a second enclosure at the back, which we think may have been used actually as a storage for explosives, because there was a lot of quarrying going on.
Yeah.
And there's a quarry at the back of it. So we think they've used some of that. And people have just been walking past this, because unless you know where it is, you can't see it from the nearby path. The three tall stones in the middle of the circle, the tallest one is about nearly 6 foot, but it looks like a gatepost from the path nearby if you don't know what you're looking at until you walk up. And then subsequently, Paul was telling me that after the discovery of it, they'd gone up there, this was in the 80s, and they'd been camping out there, him and some mates, and they'd been taking temperature because it seemed to fluctuate. It was warm in the middle of the circle than it was outside, even aligned for stone walls. But the weirdest thing, and it got me interested, he said, oh, him and his mate Stephen were up there, and Paul was sitting with his back to a wall looking at this circle. It may have been a double circle, which would be very rare up there, but nobody's sure because the stones have been moved around so much. But he saw these little black, sort of dwarf-like figures dancing in and out of the stones. And he thought, am I seeing this? Am I not? Mm-hmm. So he said to his mate, Steve, who also spoke to about this as well and confirmed it to me, would you mind swapping places? Because he said, I'm trying to roll a cigarette and I can't do it. So they swapped over. After about 10 minutes, Steve said, Paul, you're going to think I'm mad, but I can see little dwarf shapes dancing in and out of stones. So they both saw it. Now, Paul told me that, and I was interested, and obviously that got me interested going up to the site, which I have been on many times. But we were chatting in Leeds to a guy a couple of months later after this had happened.
Mm.
We bumped into a guy called Phil Hine, who now lives in London. And Phil Hine is a chaos magician. He's one of the founders of chaos magic at the time, which was a big thing. And we just bumped into him by accident in a pub in Leeds. And he was telling us he'd just come off Ilkley Moor, and Paul started to tell him about this circle. At which point, Phil told us that at the time he was living with two other chaos magicians in a house at Headingley in Leeds.
Yeah.
And three chaos magicians in a house back then, you know, forever playing tricks, hurling curses, that's the sort of thing they do. he'd been going up the stairs to the toilet, and there was this big black, he said it was about 7 to 8 foot tall shape, on the stairs looking at him. Being a chaos magician, he didn't faze him. He just thought one of the others must have been playing tricks. So he asked him what he was doing there, and he got the reply that I have been awoken from my sleep of many centuries on the moors, and basically been looking for energy, and it had gone over three chaos magicians, was presumably the equivalent of an all-you-can-eat buffet.
Yes.
So he'd gone over there, he called the other two, and they basically told him to go back where it come from.
Mm.
And ever since then, this guardian spirit has been active. And if you go up to Backstone Circle at certain times of the year, it's usually more active in the winter time. There's days when you just don't want to be there. You can turn around and come back. But having said, it's more active during the winter. There was a guy who came to my moot one time, he heard me tell this tale. He decided to camp out there in midsummer. And it's tumbled down now. You can't, where the old shed used to be, you can't really camp and put a tent because it's all tumbled in. But in those days, you could put a tent there. So he parked up in the car park, he set his tent up, and was looking forward to seeing the sunrise, except that the entire hillside appeared to be rocking to him. He thought it was an earthquake. He came running out of his tent, and he saw an 8 foot tall hooded shape, which he said was green, which was interesting because in other sites you know the more green thing, and it gave him the psychic equivalent of bugger off.
Yeah.
And he was so frightened he ran all the way down to the car park now, for anyone who doesn't know where the Bastion Circle is, running down the pathway near it is treacherous, and there's a drop of about 40 feet into that stone back if you miss your footing.
Yeah.
It's about quarter of 15 minute walk when you know where it is, but he just made it about 7 minutes flat. He spent the night in his car, and then he went back next morning, probably expecting to see all the stuff scattered, and nothing was disturbed, but he patched his gear and didn't go up there again.
So these entities, Steve, do they have a tradition of hanging around earthworks and ancient stone circles?
Some do, yes. I think they're genus loci, spirits of the place. But they're very tied to them, but I think a lot of them are. When things get disturbed, then these things pop up. Because a lot of, and obviously, if you see a hooded, black hooded chair, the thing with these hooded entities, as I call them, or technically hooded and cloak, they appear to have like a pointy top to the head. A bit like the old classic ghost, you know, the white sheet with two eyes.
Yes.
Well, these things are black, and some of them are described as absolutely solid black. You can't see anything. And even in darkness, they stand out as blacker. But they look as though they've got like a cloak on some occasions. And they usually vary between small dwarf-like shapes, about 3 to 4 foot tall, or 7 to 9 foot tall. You don't usually see any that are about our height, you know, about 5, 9, 6 foot sort of thing. You don't get them. They are seen around sacred sites, and if people damage sacred sites, this is why I think they're the guardian spirits that are put there. Sadly, most sites like them, and it's not just stone circles, they're holy wells, standing stones, things like that. I think they're put there by the people who built them. But as most sites have been damaged, then it's like the batteries run down. They're, if you like, a sort of thought form, elemental type entity, and the batteries run down. So that's why I never recommend to people to go and do rituals at sacred sites, because it's like plugging your mobile phone back in and charging it back up. You know, suddenly you can get back on the internet again when you couldn't because your battery was flat. Well, doing a ritual at a sacred site, you're charging the thing back up again.
Yeah.
So there are occasions I know where people have done this and they've got more than they expected. Classic one was at Boreham Lake, which is in Northumberland.
Mm.
There were reports at Boreham Lake, which is a nature reserve. People at the sort of all things, they reported seeing Bigfoot. Courting couple said they'd seen this big hairy monster, which he said was Bigfoot, or like Bigfoot, running through the trees and disturbing what they were doing, obviously. So the Centre of Reporting Zoology went up and investigated it. They found various things, and John Downs, who's the leader, actually had a sighting of what he described as a golden figure about 7 foot. It was glowing yellow and shot across a car park of his image, really freaked him. Though back in 2005, I was doing a talk at the CFZ's Weird Weekend, which they used to do at that time, was in Exeter, and I was talking about various including hooded entities. And these people came up to me afterwards and said, "Oh, we're from up from Sunderland. We went to Boreham Lake, and they got there just after CFZ had passed up and gone out. And they said we did this ritual to evoke the spirit of whatever was there." And we've got these photographs, which they showed me a series of photographs, and basically what was on them was, at first you could see there were colour photos, you saw like black smoke coming up, and then it got bigger, and then it got bigger, and then you could just about make out about 3 foot tall black shape with a sort of pointy hood, but it was blurred, and they said, "Oh, that's because we were running away at the time." And I said, and they said, "You know, what do you reckon it was? What do you think happened?" And I said, "Well, you know, don't be stupid. Because I said, you know, if you basically knock on a door and throw it open and say, 'Come in,' what do you think is going to happen?" Because that's what we don't. I said, "You asked for something and it came. You know, you're an idiot, basically." And I did ask for copies of the pictures, but I never received them. But that was an instance where I was asked at the time when the sighting first went up, they were asking me about it because of the sightings. And I said, is there any sacred site nearby? Is there damage? Is there a stone circle? Or is there... And the, Rich Freeman said, oh yeah, there's a mound that's been dug into, an ancient mound. And I said, well, that might have triggered it all off.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things as well, I think, obviously, when people who don't have the experience, Steve, try and evoke things, because, you know, like you say, it's a classic case of be careful what you wish for.
Exactly. These people are idiots because they're supposedly knew what they were doing, but they still went, you know, it's like licking your finger and stick it in the plug socket to see what happened. Not recommended. I mean, it took me years to actually see one of them. I've only ever seen one myself.
Mm.
And that was near 25 years after I'd been interested, because we were doing a ghost vigil at a place, Tamworth Castle. And Tamworth Castle, I can recommend once, hopefully we can all go out again, to anybody. Tamworth Castle is, it's not a ruined castle, it's a proper castle inside, proper fully... Mott and Bailey Castle, and it's the Town Museum of Staffordshire, of Tamworth. It's a bit like the TARDIS. It looks a lot smaller from the outside than when you go inside, because the galleries, when you go in, go right round the wall. So you go into what you think is just one room, and there's a door to the next room, and you're actually going in circles, so it just gets bigger and bigger. And we were in there doing a vigil, and of course, they don't just let you loose in these places, you have to have staff members. But we had about three staff members with us, and I was actually in the courtyard. It was the summertime, and I was with two staff members who were having a fag. It was fairly visible, a bit earlier than now, about this time of year, if I remember correctly. I think it was more like June, so it was later, and it was about 8 o'clock. And as I'm chatting to them, I saw out the corner of my eye this big, about 7 foot tall, black hooded shape sidling along the wall towards an opening door. And it was as though it was sort of trying to stop out of the way. It wasn't being big, scary, and leaping out in your face. It was, I could see it playing on the wall. And then it went in this doorway. And neither of the other two commented. And I said, excuse me, where does that doorway go? And they said, it doesn't go anywhere. And I said, what do you mean? They said, well, it used to go up to the battlements, because when you go inside, it's a dog leg. It goes along the road, and then it does another dog leg, which led originally to stairs that went up to the battlements. But because they are ruinous, it's blocked off. So you can go through the door, but there's a dead end. Why? And I said, well, I've just seen this 7 foot tall figure going in. Do you mind if I go in? Mm. No, if you want to. So me being me and daft, I went in. and I followed it, and I turned on this corridor, and I could see this black shape, and it sort of shot down the corridor with me following it, did a left, and I went after it, and it went straight through a solid brick wall. Wow. So when people ask me, do I believe in ghosts or weird stuff, I say, well, when you've seen something go through a solid brick wall, something's going on.
Yeah, very much so.
And subsequently, on the same night, one of the staff members who thought she was a bit like Derek Akora, she was doing a bit of, oh, I can get in touch with spirits and things. And she was talking to all of us about, you know, I've got this spirit now. And then she came to me and she said, I don't know what this is. She said, I've got something here and it doesn't like you. Mm. But I don't know what it is. She said, it doesn't feel like a normal spirit, but it doesn't like you. And I said, right, can you ask it, are you the guardian? And she went, it really doesn't like you, but it's gone now. And I thought, yes, that's probably what I saw, the genus loca.
I mean, because usually these kind of castles are more prone to be haunted, as is usually the fashion in England, Steve. They're usually, a woman in white is usually wandering around the battlements or weeping soulfully in a locked room or something. So are there any sort of traditions of these kind of genus loci inhabiting any other castles or ancient buildings in the United Kingdom?
Well, the thing is, because they are from a distance, you just see a black figure. Very often you find, you know, reports of monks.
Yes.
You know, people report monks, you know. And if you don't know what it is, you say, well, it's got a hood and a cowl, it must be a monk. And it's not unless people are close up and think, well, it hasn't got a face. Although the trigger, if they're annoyed, seems to be you get a black shape with two glowing red eyes, which crops up in lots of things. And if you see that, it doesn't. You've really done something wrong, like damaged someone. So I think, you know, people have seen them, but we've misreported them as monks.
Mm.
And they are seen at various sites. You know, I've had reports of sightings from all sorts of places. But there's different types of them. I mean, some of them seem to be, to me, guardian spirits. Mm. Others, I've had people sort of reporting things following them in the family from home to home, which seem more attached to a family, like a family ghost.
Yeah.
And the weirdest one, the last one I had reported to me a couple of years ago now, somebody was passed on to me because... they'd heard that I was interested in entities, so this guy rang me up and he said what had happened. He'd been in Iraq in the Iraq war.
Mm.
And he'd come back and he was suffering from PTSD, so he was in an army hospital, which I think was Selly Oak, although he refused to tell me which one it was. But he said he was actually in a room with, I think it was four beds, so he's in one bed, there's a guy opposite him, or just slightly opposite him, one next to him, with a guy over there. But the room he was in, there was no actual, it wasn't en suite. To get to the toilet, you had to go out through the door and along the corridor, being hospital. Yeah. And he said he woke up, and hovering over him was this sort of 7-foot-tall shape, black faceless thing, which freaked him out. And I was all set to say, right, yeah, that's classic hypnagogic, it happens when you're purposely, when he proceeded to tell me that he terrified this thing, he slept out of bed, but he sort of went, and he went out to the toilet, as you would, yeah, up the corridor, came back to find a load of doctors and nurses in the room with the guy in the bed opposite him, who totally freaked out, and they were giving him injection, because this guy said he'd woken up and seen, hovering over the empty bed, the same figure that this bloke had seen. And so he freaked out, and they come in thinking he's having hallucinations. And he said to me, the thing was, Steve, he said, I couldn't say I'd seen it, or they'd have injected me as well.
Yeah.
Because he said, what do you think it was? And I said, I honestly haven't a clue. Now, that guy thinks that his exposure to that had triggered him off for other psychic stuff, and he thought he'd become psychic as a result of seeing that. I couldn't say one way or the other, it was just straight.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose the normal explanation in the world of the paranormal, Steve, would be that was a visit from the Grim Reaper, I suspect.
Yeah. And I suspect that's what you probably thought.
Yeah.
Particularly in the context that she was, but yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, it's interesting as well, as you touch on there, because there are numerous sites across, especially in the UK, where people allegedly report sightings of monks. We've got one here in Sheffield, Stocksbridge, which is infamous.
The Stocksbridge bypass case, yeah.
But there's no history of any monastery or sect of monks or anything. There's nothing in the historical record. And the initial witnesses, most of them reported seeing a Victorian dressed, or a man in Victorian dress, rather. And yet the more modern sightings are of these kind of black amorphous shapes moving across. There's a very good witness by a couple who saw this sort of black shape move across a field and dive in front of the road in front of them. And speaking to you there, Steve, it would seem to me that if it's anything, it's more likely to be one of these genus loci or hooded entities than a monk at all.
Yeah, I always thought that. When it first came out, because the monk was, or the black shape was seen by the policeman in the police camp.
Yes.
I always thought that that was what had happened, that it wasn't a monk. I tried to get in touch, in fact, I think, with the clairvoyant who mentioned it, but I never had much success on that. Because, yes, there were sightings of children as well playing around the site of the pylon and others, but that particular one, I thought that was a classic one because they were building the bypass of disturbing something.
Yeah, exactly.
Because the police officers, if I remember rightly, that occurred on a site, a building site.
Yes, it did.
Maybe wrong, but
no, it did.
I think that's wrong. And I always thought that, yes, they'd built and they'd knocked something out and they'd triggered something.
Well, now you've sort of given some backup and explanations of other phenomenon, that seems to make far more sense to me that it could be something like that that's been disturbed, Steve, than a monk could ever be.
Yeah.
I might dig into that, because I'm not even sure, because Sheffield one is sadly quite lacking in old school earthworks and barrows and things. So that would be very interesting, because Stocksbridge is a very strange place at night at the best of times. So that's an intriguing kind of tangent to dive into there, because I've always been impressed with that story, because obviously, I mean, any bypass that opens on Friday the 13th is always looking for trouble.
Yeah.
On top of all the other stories, Steve.
Yeah.
I mean, is there anywhere else where that seems to be a hotspot for these entities in the UK, Steve?
They're all over. I mean, I've had three reports from Stonehenge. There was a clip, it may still be on YouTube, or somebody filmed, from the outside of the circus. You can't wander into the middle of Stonehenge now unless it's open. There was a film of like a black shape, and it's in daylight, passing between the stones of the inner circle, which is interesting. But I'd heard various people report, usually when there was nobody else around, driving out there, that this was all before the visitor centre was built, so the old car park where you could park up and then walk in. But on days when it was not particularly full, they'd sort of look back and seen a black hooded shape still looking at them. And in every occasion, the people just thought it was somebody dressed up for the tourists.
Yeah. You know?
I gave my talk on hooded entities at the 14 Times End convention in 2001, if I'm wrong. Yeah. And there was a girl sitting on the front row with a mother who sort of nudged her mum. And when I came to the Q&A at the end, she put her hand up and said they'd actually been to Stonehenge the day before. And coming out of the car park on the way back, because she was French, she was a role model over here for sure. She'd looked back and seen this figure, and she'd said to her mum what she'd seen, and her mother didn't believe it because her mother didn't see anything. So it was like, see, mum, I told you, you know, I've seen that.
Yeah, I mean, that also plays into the fact that, you know, I've come across witness reports where they're amongst a group of people in a castle or a cave or something, Steve, and two or three of the party see something and everybody else doesn't see anything. So clearly is that a question that particular person's more tuned in?
I think it is. I mean, I came up with what I call my deck of cards theory, other than say it's the archetype, which is basically that, you know, with our brain, when we see something or we pick up on something strange, we've got these archetypes in our head to pinch Sigmund Freud, which are things like the black dog, the wing man, the big hairy monster, and it includes the hooded entity, or the little black dwarf, or the big shape. Yeah. And basically what happens is, in a way of identifying it to us, our brain deals a card, and so I might see a 7 foot tall shape, you might be seeing it as a little 3 foot tall dwarf, and the girl next to us might be seeing a black dog. And unless you all get together afterwards, you know, if you all run away and don't talk to one another, you'll find three separate reports. Where if you get together down the pub and go, what did you see? That's when you start to realise people see things slightly differently.
Yeah, very much so. It is intriguing that I've always found that fascinating, where one person will see something. It's I've seen numerous stories like that. So yeah, it that doesn't surprise me in the slightest, Steve.
Yeah, it depends what people see, you know. But you can get stuck where you see it. And like I said to you, I mean, as an example of things that people see and you don't realise what you're seeing at the time, I was at Tutbury Castle in Staffordshire. Tutbury's on the borders of Staffordshire and Derbyshire. We're doing a ghost vigil again. Group of us from the civil service have gone along. You've got the one of the place, but you've got guides with you, you know.
Yeah.
And it was actually, you know, we were wandering around, three friends of mine. Now, Tutbury Castle's got various ghosts, but one of the ghosts is supposed to haunt the gatehouse. There's a ruin, the gatehouse, it's a ruined castle. It was like a lot, it was blown up after the Civil War to stop it being garrisoned. So the gatehouse is ruined. And there is actually supposed to be the ghost of a knight in full armour, which is seen even in broad daylight, and speaks old English. It's a weird one, it's actually spoken to people.
Wow.
Along the lines of get thee out.
Yeah.
One woman who saw it thought it was a reenactor. But on this occasion, myself and two friends were walking across the lawn with it towards the Great Hall, which is still intact and going. And again, it was summertime, so it wasn't dark. As we're chatting about what we're going to do and things would happen, I saw the gates of the gatehouse, big heavy wooden gates across with a big wooden bar, you know, behind, stopping it coming in. And it was only after like 30 seconds, because I thought, wait a minute. And I said, wait a minute, I've just seen come out the gates in the gatehouse, big wooden gates with the bar across.
Yeah.
And they said, yeah, we saw that. And of course, when we looked, there it was all in ruins, no gates, nothing. But all three of us had sort of seen them. But because you naturally think that's what you expect to see, we hadn't remarked on it, we hadn't thought it was strange. And it was only when I thought, well, no, hang on, they shouldn't be there, that we realised, and they were.
How strange. Was that? So that's kind of more like either a reenactment or a time slip, Steve.
Yeah, I don't know. It could have been a reenactment. It could have been a time slip, or it could be your brain filling in what you expect to be there. You know, because everyone's seen films about Robin Hood and everything else, so you sort of expect Gates to be like that. I don't know what it was, but all three of us saw it. And you know, we hadn't been talking about it, we had nothing to trigger it, but when I remarked on it, the other two had seen it as well, but I hadn't thought about it, because their brain had thought, that's natural, and it's only when it's brought to attention, you go, right.
Yeah, yeah, very much so. I mean, it's one of those things that it just seems to occasionally appear for the right people at the right time, Steve.
Yeah, you get people who things happen to them. I mean, statistically, one in three person will have something strange happen, and you know, you get strange stuff that doesn't. There's no follow up to it. It's just weird, and you can't account for it. I had basically what is an apport happen in my bedroom here in the house I'm in.
Yeah.
For those people who don't know, an apport is when something appears from nowhere, as opposed to something vanishing. And what happened, I've been in the house, so I should explain, this is the house I'm talking to you from, built around the 1840s, it's an old house. The road outside the house is an unmade road. I'd not been out of the house. It was a Sunday afternoon, broad daylight, about roughly 2 to 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and the computer I was using at the time was in my bedroom, and it was at the end of my bed, so I'd been sitting on it.
Yeah.
I hadn't been out of the house since the Friday, so I'd not been out for like 2 days anyway. And as I was chatting, I was on the computer, I got up and I saw something shining on the carpet with a glint of silver. I bent down to see what it was, and as I was bending down towards it, my brain was sort of going, oh, it's a coin, it's a funny-looking coin, oh, it's a foreign coin, and this is how your brain works, and,
yeah.
And it's like, I've not been above for you. Pick this thing up. Now, I still have it. It's a silver threepenny bit. Victorian silver Bepany piece. But it was, I couldn't have missed it. I couldn't have avoided it. I had not been at the house, so it couldn't have fallen off my shoe. There is a wooden beam that goes over part of my bedroom, but it wasn't over the, that. It wasn't underneath it, so it couldn't have been like rammed into cracking the beam as some people do for love. So it couldn't have fallen out of there, because in which case it'd been in the bed. And it wasn't in that area. And there was no way that I could have missed it walking past it in 2 days, which was the last time I'd been out, you know.
Yeah.
And there was no, it's never happened since. I still have it. I don't know where it's come from. I had never had a silver threatening bit, and the only thing I'd heard of silver threatening bits is in sticking in Christmas puddings in Victorian times.
Yeah. How peculiar. Because, I mean, if it was like modern denomination, you could probably say, well, maybe I've dropped it and I've not seen it, whatever. But for something that's, you know, completely defunct and out of service for decades, to stumble across something like that just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, and it's just like, you know, one of those things, you know, weird shit, as John Down says. I've never seen anything since, nothing's happened, I've not seen any ghosts in this house, nothing. But there it was, you know. I have got no explanation for it whatsoever, you know.
How peculiar. I mean, have you had any sort of amusingly strange encounters with the paranormal, Steve?
Yeah, I had the Phantom Farter in Newark. one of the things I've actually been reading over the thing is actually the on my Kindle is actually Ghost Walk of Newark. So I'm not sure whether the museum, because this is quite a few years ago. Basically, what happened, I went to Newark actually looking, sort of wander around at haunted sites, because I've got books by Rosemary Robbins, which are some excellent books on Ghosts of Newark. So I've gone down there, I've looked in the then museum, I believe there is a new Civil War museum since I was there, but in the old museum, which wasn't up to much, I was told that there was basically a folk museum in Newark, and I was given directions as to how to find it. So I went down and I found the folk museum and I went round. It's in an old mill, or it was. Great time, wandered around it. I was a little put out to see reel-to-reel tape recorders marked as what our ancestors used to listen to. But I came out and there's a pub next door. So I went in and I was in desperate need of the toilet. So I ordered a pint, because I'm not one of those people who dashes in and uses the pub loo and comes out again. And then I went in the gents. And I needed to use the stalls without being crude. And I went into, so I was looking at the stall farthest away from the door, but I realised there was no toilet paper in that one. So I went in the one next to it, and while I was sitting there doing what you have to do, I heard these tremendous farts coming from the stall next door, real sort of raspberry type stuff, and I was just basically thinking, oh god, you must have had a really bad curry or something. And then I thought, wait a minute, I haven't seen anybody go past, because you know, you can see below, you can see, but I've not heard any footsteps. And I thought, there's no toilet paper in there. So if there was somebody, I sounded, then, you know, I mean, they were in for a big shock. So I finished what I was doing, flushed the toilet, come out, nobody had gone past me again, looked, and the door was wide open, but there was nobody in there. And I checked to see if there was any toilet, you know, anything in the stuff. Can you still hear me? Because I think I've frozen.
No, I can hear you absolutely fine, Steve.
Right, fine. I was worried. Yeah, so there was nobody in there. I looked in the toilet bowl to see, because I thought maybe it's a case of water pressure, you know, air bubbles making noises, pipes. And there was none. It wasn't. So I came out, and it was one of those weird ones where I didn't really know how to approach, because it was a young girl behind the bar. And if I'd seen, like, a white lady come through the wall, I would have happily said, you know, is there a white lady ghost that haunts the gents? I've seen some, or a couple of it. But going up to her and saying, have you got a phantom farter in the pub? Was a bit weird. So what I did, I had the ghost put with me. So I put the ghost book next to the pint on the bar, which I picked up and said, oh, by the way, you know, looking point to the book, is there any ghosts in this pub by any chance? Hoping she'd go, oh yeah, there's some new farts in the gents' toilet. But all she said was, no, it's a new pub, don't be daft. So maybe, you know, if anyone is, it happens to be in Newark, if the pub's still there, please go in the gents and see if you find anything.
How peculiar. I mean, that's, yeah. I mean, toilet ghosts are quite rare anyway, Steve, because, you know, there are a few stories of...
No, but they're not actually, Paul.
No,
haunted toilets in pubs and other places are the most common ones that you will come across. There's loads of... There are loads of haunted ladies' toilets, there are loads of haunted gents' toilets, but usually where people see things... There was a pub in Leeds actually where the gents' toilets were haunted by allegedly by a green lady, and that was a weird one because actually she'd been murdered in the stables.
Yeah.
That used to be there. They were then converted into gents' toilets, which is why you got it. I know lots of people where, whether it's water seems to be a conduit, whether it's a conduit for ghosts. I know you can mistake mist and stuff like that for things, but it seems to act as some sort of conduit where somewhere it's damp or it's a high water table, you get people who put in ghosts. And toilets, yeah, there's loads of them out there. The Tuckley Castle case I referred to earlier, I didn't see it myself, but I went in the gents there and there was two guys who were on the same thing as I was, both angrily denying that each of them had been farting because both of them had heard a fart and nobody there. And I then said, yeah, right, guys, I have heard something, you know, but not this. They're more common than you think.
Well, I'll keep my eye out for that. I think there's a niche of books that somebody needs to write, Steve.
Yeah, you know, Haunted Toilets in Great Britain will be a good guidebook.
Absolutely, I think we should collaborate on that.
I'm sure your listeners can write in with their own stories.
Very true. So, listen, Steve, thank you very much for your time this evening. It's been a real pleasure to get an insight into the world of paganism and your life and your experiences around the UK and thereabouts. So where can everybody keep up to date? And if they fancy coming along to a moot, what's the best way to find you?
If you're on Facebook, there's a Wakefield Pagan Moot group and page, which will tell you when the next one is and how to find us. And I'm on Facebook as well. So if you look up Steve Jones and it says organiser Wakefield Pagan Moot, that's me. So I'm quite happy to accept people as friends, provided they're not complete idiots. Or if you are a complete idiot, at least you've got to be as much of an idiot as I am, you know.
Well, why not? That's good company to keep, Steve, I suspect.
Yeah.
Well, listen, thank you for your time today. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you for fitting me in, and it's been brilliant. So thank you for your time, Steve.
It's been enjoyable, Paul. Thank you.
Thank you.